I'm Sheila Kast, and this is Midday. Former NAACP President Ben Jealous today put out a six-point plan to improve police-community relations in Baltimore. One of its planks, fire corrupt officers. Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun tells us more. We'll also hear from two protesters who were arrested for occupying City Hall this week. Plus, news headlines from the Baltimore Business Journal and some historical perspective on why zoning is a public health issue. And this weekend is the Baltimore Running Festival. We speak with Lee DiPietro, who ran the Baltimore Marathon 8 times and came in second twice. She tells us how her love of running gave her strength during difficult times. All this on Midday, Friday, after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Kast. I'm glad you've joined us. Later in the hour, we'll get to some business news headlines, a discussion of Baltimore's slow revision of its zoning law, as well as some insights into how earlier zoning restrictions are still taking a toll. And we'll talk about the Baltimore Running Festival. But we'll start by examining some of this week's discussion about Baltimore City Police. On Wednesday night, a Baltimore City Council committee voted 3-1 to approve making Kevin Davis the permanent police commissioner. His title, since Mayor Rawlings Blake appointed him in July to replace Anthony Batts, has been interim commissioner. The full city council is to vote on Davis's appointment next week. Wednesday's committee meeting was interrupted by demonstrators who called for a meeting with Commissioner Davis and made other demands. We'll speak with two of the protesters in just a few minutes. But first, the latest development. A six-point plan put out by former NAACP President Ben Jealous for police-community relations in Baltimore. Baltimore Sun reporter Luke Broadwater is covering the story. He joins us by phone. Welcome back to Midday, Luke.
Thanks for having me, Sheila.
Sure. What does this plan aim to accomplish?
Well, the plan is it's simple, it's straightforward, it's things that the city can actually accomplish and implement. These are not requests that require the governor to change the law or redirect state funding or something like we've heard from other groups in the past. This is the first one is to actually fire bad police officers, police who are brutal, police who are corrupt. That is well within the police commissioner's authority to do, and Mr. Jealous wants to see more bad cops fired. The second point is also within the city's control, and that is to cease and desist with the gag orders on police settlements. Police settlements right now, the parties sign a statement saying they won't talk about it in the future. That's the second point. He also wants more training for de-escalation techniques. He wants all police policies to be posted on the internet for anyone to read, and he has some specific recommendations about how to improve community policing as well. So there's a press conference actually about to start in probably about 10 minutes or so in which Mr. Jealous and a coalition of 25 community groups will be talking at some length about these proposals. So that should be interesting to hear them discuss that as well.
Right, and I don't want to keep you from getting to that. I'd like to home in on the first one you pointed out, though, about firing bad cops.
Correct.
To some degree, that gets done already. So I'm assuming that this is really pointing to saying it doesn't happen quick enough. The standards are too low. I mean, what does this really mean?
So there's a couple things. One, as you well know, and as most of you who follow this issue know, we have the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights in Maryland. Some have said it's the toughest, strongest Bill of Rights for any interest group in the entire country. And what that basically says is you cannot be fired without due process. And due process takes quite a while. You have to have a trial board hearing. There's some leniency with how quickly you have to give your statements. After the hearing, then you go up to the police commissioner for a final decision. We have seen in the past police commissioners fire people even when a trial board hasn't hasn't recommended them be fired. Case in point was Commissioner Bielefeld back in the day. I'm sure you remember that video where the officer berated a young man on a skateboard at the Inner Harbor.
Yeah, I remember the video.
Right, yeah. The trial board said he shouldn't be disciplined, and Bielefeld went ahead and fired him. You're allowed to do that as a police commissioner. So I think Jellison's recommendation is about two parts. One, use the power you do have more often to get rid of these bad cops rather than, just going with the trial board all the time. He wants to see tougher punishment from the chief police, from the chief of police. But then also have the mayor and the legislature really take this issue down to the General Assembly and see if the law enforcement officer bill of rights can't be altered in some way to try to get more of these officers off the streets more quickly if they are indeed corrupt cops, as Mr. Jellis says.
That's Luke Broadwater, reporter for the Baltimore Sun here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're going to be talking a few more minutes with Luke and then with two of the protesters who were arrested Wednesday. If you want to be part of this conversation, you've got a few minutes to give us a call on this topic. And our phone number is 410-662-8780, or you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Yeah, I'm thinking just this week, Luke, the video surfaced of what seems to be a veteran of the police force spitting on a suspect. Kevin Davis, the interim commissioner, said, troubling, got to look at it. The mayor pretty quickly said he ought to be fired. So
that's correct, yeah. So the mayor said, what she said was he should resign.
That's right.
She knows, and the commissioner knows, that the most they can do right now, unless he's been charged with a felony, is suspend him without pay under the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights. So that's the very most they can do, and that's what they've done. He's been suspended with pay. That's the most that can be done to him at the present time. The mayor is encouraging him publicly to resign. The police commissioner is saying, I don't know what more we can do unless the law has changed. Obviously, if he goes to a trial board, that could eventually go up to the commissioner, and he could fire him. But that, you know, will take several months, if not longer. And it's a great example. You know, I was listening to some of the protesters' demands the other night, and they said they want the officer fired immediately. And I think the mayor would love that. It sounded like from her comments, but obviously her hands are tied by the state law.
Luke, you mentioned a coalition. I mean, obviously, Ben Jellis, former head of the NAACP, has been the most visible face of this six-point plan. Who else is behind it?
Sure. The Reverend Heber Brown, many people know him, prominent pastor in town. The ACLU, the Center for American Progress, which was, one of the big sponsors of this study and this work. And numerous other, there's some labor unions, I think CASA, the Maryland's in there. There's a good coalition of activists, community, civil rights groups, and religious groups that were consulted on this proposal.
And real quickly, Luke, where do you think it goes now? What happens next?
Well, so yesterday I spoke with both the mayor's office and the police commissioner, and they said they're happy to meet with Mr. Jellis and the activists and want to hear their ideas more in depth and perhaps implement them. It does seem that some of them are already in the works. One of the recommendations that I actually neglected to mention earlier was to implement body cameras within a year, and this month the police department is equipping 150 officers with body cameras. I think Mr. Jellis would like to see them do it more quickly, but the city is phasing in a body camera program over the course of several years.
Luke, thanks.
Thank
a
you.
Lot. Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun. This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, and we've invited two of the protesters who were arrested early Thursday to be here to share their perspectives, Trey Murphy and Michaela Gilliam Price. Trey Murphy is an organizer with the Baltimore Algebra Project and Baltimore Block, a grassroots organization that's made up of youth, community representatives, families, to address police accountability and transparency. Welcome, Trey.
Thank you for having me.
I'm glad you're here. Baltimore Block put out a letter to Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake and Commissioner Kevin Davis on Monday with specific demands about how protesters should be treated by police. What prompted the letter?
Yeah, so I think a number of things prompted the letter. In the wake of the tragedy of Freddie Gray, I think a lot of citizens inside of Baltimore has awakened to some of the systematic issues that have existed here inside of the city for years, right? Where we've had, in the last 5 years alone, we've had millions of dollars in police brutality settlements paid out to victims, to families of victims of police brutality, as well as the last 5 years alone, we have had a multitude of harassments and police violence just taking place. So that's one aspect of things. I think the second aspect of things that prompted this letter was the interim commissioner, Kevin Davis, when he took office as interim, taking over for the former police commissioner, Batts, after he was fired. One of the things that we immediately noticed is that there became a heightened response on the part of police officers, where they directly targeted peaceful protesters. And in some cases, they even said police officers said specifically out of their mouth that they were sent to make an example out of one or two of the protesters to try to deter protesters from being out there, raising their voices, elevating and lifting their First Amendment right. So this letter was directly targeted at the mayor and the police commissioner to say, hey, we're not going to take this. We're not going to let you guys try to deter us from exercising our First Amendment right. And we don't have to resort to unconventional methods to force you guys to listen. Let's figure out how we can sit down and come to the table of compromise, right? And let's figure out how we implement some rules of engagements that we can both respect on both sides. So that's what really prompted this letter. And this letter actually had been sent to the mayor and former police commissioner, Anthony Batts, not the first three paragraphs, but the rules of engagement that exist inside the open letter had been sent to the mayor and the former police commissioner, Anthony Batts, after the uprising had taken place back in May.
So you were already, what I'm trying to get clear on is the difference that you talked about, that you perceive between how protests are being handled by the police department under Kevin Davis compared to how they were handled by his predecessor. You already had concerns.
Correct.
When Anthony Batts was commissioner.
So we had concerns when Anthony Batts was commissioner. Then when Kevin Davis came on board, those concerns went up, because there was direct targets to some of the leaders of the protest.
Let me pull Michaela Gilliam Price into this conversation. She's a senior at Baltimore City College and the founder of City Block, a student grassroots organization that aims to provide an outlet for youth activists. Michaela, on Wednesday and Thursday, did the protests proceed the way that you had hoped?
Absolutely. I think even exceeded my expectations. So in the beginning of the hearing, we had, do you remember who it was that made the statement threatening that we would be escorted out? Well, I don't know. But one of the members who was sitting on the board that would be voting Kevin Davis in.
One of the city council people.
Yes. He said that if they had any interruptions during the hearing, that we would be escorted out immediately. Well, after three warnings were given. So we were obviously made very nervous by that, because we didn't think that we would be able to get through any of our protests, any of our demands, any of voicing our opinions. But then Kevin Davis got up, and while he was defending himself and justifying his stance, he said that he will always respect protesters. And so I just threw a little statement in the beginning of my mic check that said, Kevin Davis, if you truly respect protesters, you will not stand by while we are escorted out for expressing our political opinions in this space that is for expressing political opinions. And so we started the mic check, which lasted, I think, like 3 to 4 minutes.
Just take a second to explain to people mic check.
Oh, so a mic check, I call mic checks like the flash mob of protesting. So it's usually at a ceremony or any like public event where it's like usually a formal event where one person will stand up and say mic check, and then there's a prepared narrative where line by line one person will say the line and the rest of the protesters will repeat. So we got through the mic check, which lasted about 3 to 4 minutes, that had our demands embedded into it, which discussed why we as students needed this space to perform civil disobedience in order to get those demands across, because we as students of Baltimore City do not yet have the right to vote. I'm only 17 years old, and many of the people there who were representing students also do not have the right to vote, right? So it was very key that we had that space to express our political opinions in that way. And then at the very end of that mic check, the very last lines were expressing that we were not going to leave until those demands were met, and that was the proclamation of our occupation. And we did not leave until we were escorted, well, until we were arrested.
Okay. Let me ask Trey the same question. Do you feel like you accomplished with the protests this week and the arrests? Is that what you meant to accomplish?
Was it the original intent? I think that it depends on how you're looking at this thing. What I will say is that the positives that came out of this thing was that this thing trended nationally and internationally, right? This became an issue that a lot of people across the country can resonate with because of the very mere fact that the police commissioner, the interim police commissioner, and the mayor had a very simple decision to make. Come to the table, compromise, meet with the protesters. They was both very in the vicinity. They could have easily figured out what we wanted, how we can accomplish it, and we could have moved forward from there. Wouldn't have had there been an occupation, right? So in that aspect, they made themselves look bad, and that was a great accomplishment on our end in and of itself. I think where the lines get blurry a little bit is that the original intent was to have them meet out demands immediately. And that didn't happen, right? And it was very simple. Nobody had to go to jail. It was very simple. Just come, sit down, let's talk this thing out. But that didn't happen. And so as a result, folks had got arrested. Young people in particular got arrested. The phone lines of the police commissioner, the phone lines of the mayor, the phone lines of the jails was overcrowded. Folks was agitated. They was upset because this is an issue that a lot of people can resonate with. And there was just no response on the side of the people who are supposed to represent us and have our best interests at heart.
Michaela Gilliam Price, describe to me what the arrest was. There were three juveniles. You were one of three juveniles arrested, correct? How did that unfold? Were you surprised? Were you scared while it was going on?
We were absolutely terrified. So we were using the power of social media throughout the entire action to document what was happening. But I think the live stream of our arrest was one of the most powerful ones. So we had about three people periscoping that action. And I saved that video so people can find it. City Block will be posting it later. So they gave us warnings, and a few people had to leave, not because they wanted to leave, but because they had prior obligations. We have many students that were there, Towson University students in particular, who were applying to law school, to grad school, who just could not afford to be arrested. But we had a lot of people who were able to check their privilege and say, I am willing to do this for this cause. And so it was only 16 of us left by the third warning. And we were chanting Assad's chant. Which is, it is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love and support one another. We have nothing to lose but our chains. And I think that encaptured the true spirit that we had been enduring for that entire 10 hours when we were not granted access to the bathroom, when we were not granted access to the food that our supporters outside of City Hall had brought for us. And at that moment, when the third warning was issued, about, I would say, like, anywhere between 30 to 45 police officers marched in two lines and just started picking off one by one our circle that we had formed by linking arms and started arresting people. Two cameramen who were simply there to document what was going on, who had nothing to do with the action, were also arrested. So it's like it was an extremely demeaning space to be in. And then when we were taken to the jail as the only minor who was taken to baby bookings, it was one of the most dehumanizing experiences that I've ever endured. So while when the three of us were together, like in a waiting room, waiting to be processed, they were extremely cordial. They were very polite. But as one of the main organizers of this action, and I'm sure they were aware of that, they being the police officers, when I was alone, they would say like very underhanded statements like, oh, thank you for this protest. We're getting overtime for it. You're building up the money in my pockets. Or, oh, and I should also thank you for what you did in April. April because we were working 12 hours every day for 2 weeks. And so we were just making bank, right? And so it was just showing how they were capitalizing, how are they being verbally abusive and continuously trying to break our spirits.
Well, let me mm-hmm. home in on that just a bit. We don't have a lot of time here. But when you say verbally abusive, I mean, did they say... I mean, I take your point that they were not taking this as seriously. Their words indicated, as you report them, that they were not taking it as seriously as you were. But verbally abusive seems to me to be a more powerful
right.
kind
so,
of
and it's
language.
Subjective.
Did that take
and
place?
And I'm very deliberate when I say that, absolutely. And so it's not, I think it's one, a subjective thing, right? And my experience should never be delegitimized because I experienced what I experienced, right? And to be in a very affirming space with people, to be starved, literally, to not have access to bathroom for 10 hours, right? And then to go to a jail cell, right? Where I have white male police officers. I was only ever handled or checked or taken by a woman police officer once I got to the juvenile center. And so it was in a very threatening space that I was put in a very threatening position that I was put in, but we endured it nevertheless, right? And when I say verbally abusive, it's subjective and it's in comparison and contrast and should be juxtaposed to the affirming space that I was in prior to that, right? And so when I say verbally abusive, it's all about dehumanizing individuals and showing that they do not matter in a space. And that's exactly what took place in the juvenile detention center.
So have you, I just want to get clear before we take a break, have you heard from either the commissioner's people or the mayor's people about a next step?
Yeah, so they've both reached out, both offices, the office of the commissioner and the office of the mayor. And a part of the next steps, even before I go in, I just want to clear one thing up, that the mayor came out and publicly said that she didn't understand the demands. And one of my responses to that for everybody here is that the mayor should definitely check her Twitter because everybody tagged her inside the demands around the protest. And she should also check some of the news articles as well if she still doesn't understand the demands. But getting back to your question, so both offices reached out to the office of the mayor and the office of the police commissioner to try to figure out some time to set up some time. A part of the next steps is that what we're saying is that we are calling for transparency and accountability. A part of calling for transparency on that end is also making sure that we're transparent on our end. And so we have to figure out a way of how we ensure that we're representing a massive amount of people because they are just refusing to meet with massive amount of people who find this issue valid. Right. And so a part of the next steps for us is making sure that whatever gets said, that they commit to it in a way that we can hold them accountable to it and that it's transparent.
Will you keep in touch with us as this unfolds?
Yes.
Thank you very, very much. Trey Murphy, an organizer with the Baltimore Elder Project and Baltimore Block, and Michaela Gilliam Price, a senior at Baltimore City College and founder of City Block. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, headlines with the Baltimore Business Journal. Stay with us here on Midday WIPR. Welcome back to Midday. Sheila Cast here. And think about this. When you graduated from college, were you ready for the costs of the real world? That's part of what my next guest, Jonathan Munshaw, has been thinking about. Jonathan is associate editor of the Baltimore Business Journal. He's got a fascinating article out, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But first of all, welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me on.
And let's start with some of the other headlines in the Baltimore Business Journal. H&S Bakery is planning a warehouse expansion in Fells Point. Tell us a bit about the bakery.
Sure. So they've been around for a long time in Fells Point, and now they are starting to expand. They're going to invest $10 million in the new warehouse. It's going to increase their size to about 62,000 square feet. And already they
Do you know where they are currently? I mean, how much of an expansion is this?
Oh, that's up from about, I believe, 24,000 square feet. So it's at least doubling, if not more, their size.
And is this a brand new building or a conversion of... their existing neighbor.
It's going to be a little bit of a conversion because they're taking a warehouse that's already existing in Fells Point and kind of like building into it.
So what's going to – that kind of expansion, what does that mean for their operation?
Well, certainly it's going to be able to increase their production. I think they're also doubling the amount of trucks that they can hold in terms of distribution. The way that the warehouse is going to be set up, hopefully it won't be too much of a burden on traffic, but they're doubling the amount of trucks that they can use at one time, so it's certainly going to increase their distribution. They haven't really said anything about the total number of employees or anything like that, if there's any potential new hiring. They already have quite a few employees that are based in Baltimore now, but certainly just in terms of their production, it'll certainly be able to help with that, just because they're going to be able to move more trucks in and out, and in terms of the production of their actual products, they'll be able to increase.
And the city's Commissioner for Historical and Architectural Preservation will review H&S Bakery's plans. Why are they involved?
I believe it's just because of the nature of the area. And as I said, there's going to be an older warehouse that's going to be part of this project. So I would assume it has something to do with that.
Okay. What's the timeline for the whole thing being approved?
That I don't know. And okay. I'm not sure if we cover that in the article, to be honest.
I didn't remember it. That's why
yeah.
That's why I asked you. But let's go over another story. The one about the Maryland Chamber of Commerce's business policy conference. What is the business policy conference? Who takes part in it?
So it's held every year, and this year it went over 2 days on the Eastern Shore. And usually it's just a gathering of business people, frankly, and government officials and leaders in the business industry who gather and talk about what's going to be happening in the upcoming legislative session and what are some things that they might want to be looking out for in the future.
And Rick Seltzer on the BBJ staff wrote a piece about the conference and quoted Maryland Senate President Mike Miller's remarks, quote, "State government is not your enemy," close quote. So I'm trying to picture the conversation in which that needed to be said. Tell me what you know about it.
Yeah, so he came up on stage after, I believe, Boyd Rutherford gave some remarks.
Governor.
Yes. And after that, Mike Miller was on stage, and he was talking and basically saying, you know, kind of touting all the things that the state Senate has done since their time in office. And they've reduced the rain tax. They've tried to reduce certain fees and things like that. So he's basically saying that they've already done these things to try to cut taxes, and that in the upcoming legislative session, that's something else that businesses can expect to see.
Okay, so the lieutenant governor made those comments, and then the Senate president starts speaking.
Yeah, it was kind of a back and forth. I think the nature of Rick's article as well showed this, that it was kind of a fight over who was going to take credit for what, to be honest.
Well, as I understand it, because I've heard Mike Miller and Speaker Mike Bush talk about this before. I mean, they had appointed the Augustine Commission, the commission
yes.
chaired by the retired CEO of Northrop Grumman.
Yes, and
right?
That commission was the group that made those recommendations, as I said, to reduce taxes for retired military personnel and the rain tax adjustments as well.
So this tussle that that Rick Seltzer was covering, what are the implications for this coming legislative session of that kind of pull? I mean,
how
will that play out?
Hopefully there aren't any, frankly, but I think it would just kind of the usual politics, frankly. Just hopefully there's always a good outcome at the end of the legislative session, and that people can come to a compromise, hopefully cut more taxes in the future for businesses, make Maryland a more business-friendly state. And basically then it boils down to who wants to take credit for what. There are some Democrats in the state who are saying that Hogan is taking too much credit, and the Republicans are saying that Hogan is, frankly, not taking enough credit. So it's really just about when you're looking at the results, it's about who's taking responsibility for what and trying to put that on their resume for the future.
It's Jonathan Munshaw, associate editor of the Baltimore Business Journal, here on Midday on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. I really enjoyed your cover story. I want to talk about that. The story you wrote about how expensive it is to live in the Baltimore region and how tough it is to be a recent college grad. You are a recent college grad?
Yes, I just graduated from Towson in May.
In May.
Yes. So I've only been out of college for six months now.
Right. And you communicate in this article, which has great all kinds of great graphics with it also, but your text, you communicate shock, just shock. I wouldn't even say shock and awe, shock at how expensive it is to live on your own. Tell us part of what you found. Well, first of all, what prompted you to write such an article?
Well, the American City Business Journals, who's our parent company, there's 40, I don't want to get this wrong, but there's over 40 business journals throughout the country in mm-hmm. all sorts of different markets. So we put together this project where we wanted to compare the cost of living in various cities. So it was just a project that I took on, and I kind of set out.
In other words, the other business journals in other cities were looking at that same question,
yes.
cost of living in that city.
Yeah,
so you had all this, you had access to how it was working in lots of cities.
Correct. So if we wanted to compare ourselves to how much it costs to live in Baltimore versus, say, Akron, Ohio, or Honolulu, Hawaii, we have the data there to be able to do that. And specifically for Baltimore, we had just kind of come up with the idea for in terms of what text we wanted to put as part of the package. It was kind of just a reflection. I'm by far the youngest person. I shouldn't say by far because we generally have a young office, but I'm one of the younger staff members in the office, and I'm the only one who's recently graduated from college. Most people have been out of college for about 3 or more years, I would say. And that's kind of what prompted it is, you know, the cost of living in every city changes every year because prices fluctuate so much, rents change, circumstances change, things like that. So I just kind of set out to write a personal narrative about finding out how expensive it is.
So let me ask you about that personal narrative. I think I know the answer from reading it, but you tell us what for you as a recent college grad has been the most surprising expense? What has set you back more than you expected?
Well, I don't know if there's anything that's personally caught me by surprise. Thankfully, when I went to Towson, I lived in an off-campus apartment for 2 years. So that got me used to paying, cable bills, electric bills, water bills, all that kind of stuff. But the thing that's most surprised me is just that I need to catch up on a lot of stuff that most adults have in their apartment, frankly, or their homes. I still live in an apartment with a roommate, so that kind of that helps with the cost still, thankfully. But I don't have a box spring on my – or I do have a box spring on my bed. I don't have a bed frame. So the box spring and the mattress is kind of set on the floor.
Who needs a bed frame?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe I'll get one eventually. I still don't have a dining table because I used to live with two other roommates in my on-campus apartment when I went to Towson. And before that, I lived in the dorms on campus, which meant that all my furniture was provided for me, and I had a meal plan at the same time, too. So I've kind of slowly adjusted into this new way of living, and even though I have a steady income, and I'm thankful to have that, I'm still playing catch-up.
Very quickly, before we take a break on this story, as you said, you had access to lots of cost of living insights in lots of cities. Where is Baltimore the most of a bargain in what area, and where is Baltimore surprisingly expensive compared to other cities? In what types of purchases?
Sure. Well, actually, in terms of groceries, we are pretty reasonable. We compare ourselves to D.C. and Philadelphia because for the business journal markets, those are the two closest to us. And in terms of groceries, actually, we were much cheaper. One of the items I had to find was a steak. It was like a sirloin steak. And Baltimore's price was about $4, or not $4, but maybe like $2 to $3 lower than Philadelphia and Baltimore. Eggs, a dozen organic eggs were cheaper in Baltimore than they were in D.C. and Philly. And in terms of
food is good. What's not good?
So what's not good, actually, the one thing that we had the biggest differential on was sports tickets, actually. One of the things was if you were going to buy 4 sports tickets to the most, the biggest team in your area. So in our case, it was the Ravens. We chose to buy 4 tickets in the most expensive section, and it ran about $1,500. And that was almost $500 cheaper than they would have been for whichever team Washington chose, which I would assume would be the football team. And in Philadelphia, I would also assume would be the Eagles. I can't say that for sure, but we were significantly more expensive in that category than those two
cities. You just said cheaper a minute ago. You meant more expensive.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yeah, they were more expensive than Philly and D.C., the Ravens tickets were.
Okay, we got it. We'll ponder that while we take this short break. Jonathan is going to stay with us, and we hope you will, too. This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be back in a bit. Thank you. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you've stayed with us. Since April's rioting, what some people call Baltimore's uprising, many people have talked about segregation in the city and neighborhoods that have faced decades of disinvestment and neglect. In a few minutes, Lawrence Brown, an assistant professor in the Public Health Department at Morgan State University, will talk about how Baltimore is still feeling effects of zoning practices from the early 20th century. But first, Jonathan Munshaw, associate editor of the Baltimore Business Journal, is still with me in studio. And Jonathan, the cover story last week was about plans to overhaul Baltimore's zoning laws. This has been under study for 3 years, right? Why is it stalled?
Yeah, so I shouldn't say it's not necessarily a bill, but overall it's been called Transform Baltimore. That's the name of the new code that they're trying to pass, and it's been in the city council since 2012. And there hasn't been one particular hang-up. It's just certain amendments that are kind of holding it up, that are kind of passing through. It's kind of just slow-moving,
It is very slow-moving. I gather there's sort of a push now to get it done before this city council's term is over next year.
Yeah, the goal is to get everything done by January, and it is a pretty big project. Baltimore has – the last time it was updated was 1971, I believe, and since then Baltimore's obviously changed as a city. So you asked what kind of the hang-ups are, and back then you didn't have to zone for biomedical facilities like you have now. You didn't have to rezone for these – a lot of people are converting office spaces into homes and there are a lot of millennials who want to move into the city, and they want to live in homes that are close to businesses. They want to be able to walk to where they work. They don't want to have to own cars. So that's kind of been the holdup, is that they're completely having to rethink what Baltimore is going to look like from a real estate perspective, because they're having to plan for all of these businesses and all of these types of construction that they've never had to think about before.
Let me pull Lawrence Brown from Morgan State University, as associate professor in the School of Public Health, correct?
Hopefully soon, associate assistant now.
Assistant, okay. If I gave you a slight raise, I'm glad I could do that. You've been, I'm sure, paying as much attention as any of us to this revision, mm-hmm. this slow-moving revision of Baltimore's current zoning code, and you think of it in an historic perspective.
Absolutely.
Tell me what we should be aware of.
Well, we should be aware that in 1910, on December 20th of this year, we will celebrate 105 years of segregation in Baltimore. Baltimore was the first city to pass a comprehensive racial zoning law in the United States on that day in 1910.
So there's an actual specific date.
Yes,
under
Baltimore Mayor Jerry Barry Mahool. And the city council, then they passed that ordinance. And so in 1918, racially restrictive covenants became a part of the city under Mayor James Preston. In the first term of Mayor Howard Jackson in the 1920s, he formed a committee for segregation. In 1937, you had redlining come online with the Homeowners Loan Corporation and Federal Housing Administration.
That was a federal policy. Redlining was a federal policy.
It was jointly created because local officials helped create that map. Local real estate officials, a professor from Goucher College. So local people helped, based on the segregation that had been in place the past 20 or so years, help create that federal map. And so redlining, then also Baltimore Mayor Howard Jackson also created segregated public housing in 1937 as well. So this legacy of segregation has been with us, because even though we passed the 1968 Fair Housing Act, it has never been enforced sufficiently. So Douglas Massey, a sociologist at Princeton, calls Baltimore today a hyper-segregated city. And so that legacy is still with us.
Baltimore more than
Baltimore is in
the
top eight hyper-segregated metropolitan areas in the United States.
Well, you just very quickly pointed to us several elements of the first part of the 20th century, all of which encoded segregation. Was any of that already dissolving before the federal fair housing laws were passed in the 60s, or did those structures in Baltimore, I don't mean necessarily physical structures, but the mm-hmm. legal structures, collide headlong with the 1960s federal housing laws?
Well, you know, the Supreme Court struck down racial zoning in 1917. Buchanan versus Worley struck down racially restrictive covenants. Shelley versus Kramer in 1948. Struck down redlining in 1968 with the Fair Housing Act and with Jones versus Mayer. But the Supreme Court only says don't segregate this way. It didn't prevent you know, people from creating new ways of exclusion, new ways of segregating. So here in Baltimore, as we talk about business, for instance, one way in which we reify segregation is by continually investing billions of dollars in the Inner Harbor while allowing disinvested redline black communities to fester intense poverty in the city. So, you know, in that way, we're not, by not investing in these historically redline black communities, we're not changing the dynamic, because they remain apartheid communities, whereas our greenline communities like Roland Park, Guilford, Homeland are still greenlined and very exclusive, and they're able to zone in a way to keep out, say, affordable housing that we see maybe in the show Show Me a Hero, where David Simon is showing
HBO.
Yes, the attempt for a mayor to get public housing in a predominantly white area.
We're covering a lot really fast. We should continue this conversation sometime. Will you come back?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Assistant Professor of Public Health at Morgan State University, Lawrence Brown, and Jonathan Munshaw, Associate Editor of the Baltimore Business Journal. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
And now, big day tomorrow in Baltimore, the 15th running of the Baltimore Marathon, which is known now as the Baltimore Running Festival. More than 25,000 runners have registered for it, down about 7% from last year's registration, possibly because of concerns by some people since April's riot about coming to Charm City. Still, thousands of runners have faith in the city and in themselves. A woman who knows very well the exhilaration and exhaustion of running a marathon and beyond that, triathlons, is Lee DiPietro. In her first Ironman competition 21 years ago, she won her age group in the Ironman World Championships in Hawaii. 3 years later, she finished sixth among all women competing in the Hawaii Ironman. Over 25 years of competitive racing, DiPietro has run more than 30 marathons, six Ironmans, countless triathlons and road races. At age 50, she won her first major marathon. For many of those years, her home, her base of operations, was in Baltimore County, and now she's written a memoir that connects what she's learned as a marathoner with how she helped her family endure several health challenges. The book is called Against the Wind, An Ironman's Race for Her Family's Survival. Lee DiPietro is here in the studio. Welcome to Midday.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So, you say you started running late in life. How late?
I started after my first child was born, and I was about 26 years old.
And that's late?
Well, it was late for most runners. I think most runners will start, you know, the runners now start in college or high school. They do cross country. And I only started running just doing a mile here and there just to get fit. I was a big tennis player back then. And I really, my first competitive race was the New York City Marathon, where I ran my first road race with my own number. And I was 28 at that time. So for most runners, endurance sports runners, you really hit your peaks in your late 20s, early 30s after you've been doing it for a while.
And you hadn't been doing it for a while.
No, I was a tennis player, and I played lacrosse in college.
What hooked you on endurance running?
I was very competitive growing up. I played a lot of school sports, and I loved competing. And when I graduated from college, I played college in lacrosse. And when I graduated, I just missed that exhilaration of being in front of competing and having crowds cheer you. And
it was the competition as much as the hours actually spent running?
Yeah, and the running for me when I first started was time for myself. You know, in a busy life with children as I was growing with my I have two sons now, but it was time for me to be alone, time for me to think, solve problems, not answer the phone, not answer questions, and I fell in love with it, and it was I didn't realize there was a big competitive world at running at that point, and I discovered races and 5Ks and eventually triathlons, and I just got hooked.
How did you move into triathlons?
I had an uncle that was doing triathlons, and he said, hey, we're all going to Bermuda to do this race. Do you want to go? And I thought, that would be fun. So I went down there, and I won the amateur division of the race.
Refreshes. A triathlon includes?
A triathlon is a swim, bike, run. And they're varying distances, just like there are in road races, varying from Olympic distance to the Ironman distance. They're not all the Ironman distance, which is a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike, and then a full marathon of 26.2 miles.
You devote a fair chunk of Against the Wind to various stages of your training.
Right.
Which I'm sure would be of great interest to people who run, especially run competitively. It's daunting to a non-jock reader like me. But it also seemed to me that you're a bit amazed, too, as you look back at what you put yourself through.
I think so. And I think I didn't really truly appreciate the level of competition and my success as an athlete until I went back and started really looking over. As I wrote this book, my editor said, we need, you know, how many races did you do? How many did you win? And I went and counted them all up, and I did 400 races, and I've won over 200 of them, from, you know, running races to triathlons over the 25 years of competing. So that sort of surprised me that I had done that many and had won that many races. But it taught me a lot about myself, which is what this book really turned into, was a story about how, as a runner and an Iron Woman, you put yourself up against the odds. Can you make it? Can you run a full marathon? And these runners tomorrow will be thinking, you know, am I ready for this? And what I learned is you just, you know, you set a goal, you break it into pieces that your body and your mind can handle, because the big picture is often overwhelming.
And well, yeah, I mean, the Against the Wind, the title that you chose, I think, I assume refers to
Running against the wind.
Running against the wind, but also the setbacks in life,
right.
Especially the two huge health challenges.
Yes.
Your husband's cancer.
Yes.
Your husband, who is also Lee DiPietro.
Yes.
And your son Tim's very bad accident.
Right.
Just tell us quickly about those two challenges and how you're running gave you something to push back with.
Well, my husband was diagnosed with cancer.
This was when?
In 2010, and we were shocked. He did a lot of triathlons, and we were always very healthy, and you it's always a shock when you are surprised by something like that. And we set, when he was given his what his path would be for to treat the cancer, from the chemotherapy to the radiation, I kind of use my mentality as a runner to say, okay, you know, this is our training schedule, and these are the pieces that we have to do to get through to get to the surgery, which was, you know, basically our race at the end. And so you go through your ups and downs, much like when you're training or racing. And we got to that point where we thought it all was good, and our son gets in this horrendous accident in New York, and we were living in Baltimore. And so it's like you just have to start all over again, but you just can't give up. That's just not an option. And it never was for me when I was racing. I think I dropped out of one race in all the 400 races I did because I had cracked a bone in my heel. But besides that, you just, you reach down deep and you find a way.
And you really take us on that journey with you in this book. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
On the book. Lee DiPietro, Iron Woman, her new memoir is titled Against the Wind, An Iron Woman's Race for Her Family's Survival. It's published by Skyhorse. If you want to cheer on those running in the Baltimore Marathon, the start time tomorrow, 8 a.m., the race begins at Russell and Camden Streets. More information about the Baltimore Running Festival can be found at thebaltimoremarathon.com. So I thank you all for being here. I thank our listeners for staying with us. Here and Now is coming up next. Lunch today for our guests provided by Joe Squared. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, local craft beers for locations and hours. Visit joesquared.com and come back with us on Monday. We're going to be talking about how your brain functions. Come back to Midday. Have a great weekend.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Melody Simmons and Connor Graham. The Midday intern is Adam Droneberg. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at wypr.org.
or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.